Fangory has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine is not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your front door 4 times a year. Each issue is filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, never online, so if you want to join in on the fun, well, you're going to need to subscribe, and in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up, and if you do, I got a nifty little promo code for you. If you use the code KINKCAST at checkout, you will save 25% off of your subscription. That's Fangoria.com, code KINKCAST. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Well,
sometimes that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KINKCAST and the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name is Eric Vespi.
And I'm Don Coscarelli, today's guest host.
Yeah, we have a very John Dies at the End style show for you today. My guest co-host is the director of that film, the man who also brought you Bubba Hotep, the Phantasm series, and Beastmaster, of course, Mr. Don Coscarelli. And he is going to help me interrogate our guest. Our guest is a former editor for Crack.com who transitioned into becoming an author, publishing the John Dies at the End series, the Zoe Ash series, and his upcoming novel titled I'm Starting to Worry About This Big Black Box of Doom. Oops, I threw a big in there. There is no big in there. I'm going to go back and do that again. His upcoming novel titled I'm Starting to Worry About This Black Box of Doom, which hit bookshelves yesterday, September 24th. He's joining us to talk a bit about that, his other recent work on social media, and Stephen King's Misery, one of a very interesting title that we haven't really dug all that deep into on the show, believe it or not. So I'm really excited for this. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Jason Pargin. Pargin?
Yes.
Is that right? Okay. I just second-guessed myself, and I was like, Pargin. Nope, wrong. Okay.
Everybody in the world pronounces it wrong on the first attempt.
Well, the problem is I pronounced it correctly on the first attempt when I asked you before we started recording. This has happened one other time, and that's when I had Carlo Gugino on the show. And I pronounced it totally right, and then I did the exact same fucking thing that I just did with you, Jason. I went, please welcome Carlo Gugino. And I was just like, what the fuck is wrong with my brain? So I'm going to keep all this in. Please welcome Jason Pargin to the KINKCAST.
Easy way to remember it. It's just like animated GIF. It's pronounced exact same way.
Are you a GIF versus GIF person?
I guess it's one of those words that I was new enough to the internet at its dawn that I only ever saw it printed out because you couldn't used to do video or audio on the internet. So you had to go with however you pronounced it in your head.
Yeah.
So it was always GIF, but
Oof. Yes,
the new book is out. By the way, we did record this a little bit in advance. If the book is actually not out and you go to search it, that means something crazy must have happened. So Google my name. There must have been some sort of a tragedy or I'm in prison for them to have not published it. So it's actually even more interesting if it turns out we're wrong and the book does not exist and they've all been pulped.
Well, you know, if you do end up in prison, that's only going to help the numbers on the show. So if you want to go out and commit some light crime beforehand, you know, it'll kind of help boost the numbers a little bit. So please.
This is starting to sound like Jason's last John Dies at the End book, which is if this book exists, you're in the wrong universe.
Oh, man. I fucking love those books, by the way. And I don't think I would have found them if it wasn't for you, Don, because I've known you, Don, going back long, 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 long time. And
you were a teenager when we met.
I was. I knew you as you were doing the Bubba Hotep stuff. And, you know, of course, I was, you know, you couldn't have kept me away from that set. So I pestered you there for quite a bit. And I think it wasn't too much longer after, it was a few years after, where you're like, hey, you should pay attention to this book. You know, that I don't remember if you had gotten the rights or you were trying to get the rights at that point, but you were definitely the first person to turn me on to John Dies.
Jason was avoiding my emails at first. I sent him an email, you know, raving about the book and introducing myself. And it took him a few weeks to get back to me.
Well, I used to get spam messages that were like fake publishing offers or fake movie deal offers. That was a common thing you would get because I don't know what they were looking for back then, because listeners, this is in the ancient days of Jesus Christ, 2006, five.
In that vicinity, maybe 7 or 8, but.
But time is all a blur because, yeah, and I, you know, again, I got started writing on the internet in the late 90s blogging scene when we used to go to Ain't It Cool News and figure out, like, this is how it's done. Like, how are they on top of everything like this?
You can't listen to any of those weirdos at Ain't It Cool.
So it's funny to think that was 27 years ago or something like that. Yeah. When I was reading that and thinking, oh my gosh, this is what journalism can sound like. It can just sound like people like me, my age. And that whole scene was developed a language of the internet that stuck with me. You can still read it in my books, but yeah, at the time Don obtained the film rights, I had basically wrote and published John Dies at the End just as a series of blog posts for free. I was working at an insurance company doing like data entry and was just doing this as a hobby. And then I eventually did like a self-published run because people were having to print it off and like put it in a 3-ring binder. So I was like, well, I'll find a service that can do that for me. And a very cool little indie horror press called Permuted Press picked it up and printed a few thousand copies and got it into some bookstores. But it's hard to overstate that, like, what Don got hold of was one of not that many copies in existence. This was not a bestseller. It was a niche thing that was like kind of an viral internet story. Like today they would call it like a creepypasta or something like that. But at the time it was this thing people just handed around over email. And then by a miracle, he got, you know, the exact right person got hold of a copy of the book and not only wanted to make a movie about it, but actually did make it. Because you find out pitching stuff to Hollywood, the way it normally works is somebody says, hey, we'll pay you a fee to never make this into anything.
Yep.
And there's just, it just gets thrown into a giant mountain of projects. And so I have tried to explain to people that the lottery I won was not that somebody wanted to buy the rights. Like eventually somebody would have thrown me some money to like option the rights for a year or whatever. The thing was it got made and right. was good. That's what no other writers get. Like every writer, if you write a book that has sold some copies, they'll eventually option the rights and nothing will happen. Like that's routine. To actually have it become a film and a good film, that's the one in a million shot.
Well, you can lay a lot of that at the feet of Mr. Coscarelli here. Don, you know, I know that we've known each other. We've been friends for a very long time. I don't know if I've ever really told you just how much I admire you as a filmmaker. I mean, I definitely admire you as a good and trustworthy and loyal friend. But, you know, I've seen you in the trenches here. There, you've done the work that you were doing on Bubba, like, I still sticks with me to this day where, you know, that was such a everybody pitching in assholes and elbows production.
Yeah.
And like where you would be directing and then also like moving lights and, you know, you'd like, I remember you like loading up equipment and stuff in the Ozzie Davis wheelchair or something and rolling it around to the next setup and stuff. And you know, you actually, as somebody who wants to get their vision out there, you don't stop, you know, you don't let things beat you down and you then turn around and give us these movies that, you know, are going to continually be, you know, released and re-released and re-released, you know, because people just, you know, love them so much. So I want to take this chance to publicly tell you how much I admire that and how much I love your work.
You are too kind, and you came around and helped a lot in the publicity of getting John Dies launched. I mean, Bubba Hotep launched. But what I do want to say right away is I want to apologize for that day that you came down to the John Dies at the End set.
Oh, yeah?
That was the biggest clusterfuck I ever. First off, it was like the first time we were seeing a couple of the characters in their outdoor wear, and they looked terrible. And they were just arriving at Shelley's house, which is the character that they're doing their first adventure with. Mm-hmm. And all those shots, we spent about 5 hours there, and you hung around with your good buddy and cool guy, Aaron, watching all that stuff we just never even used in the movie. And, I didn't know. It's one of those moments you get where you're shooting something. Every angle looks bad. The actors look bad. The way they're delivering doesn't look right. And that's what you witnessed that day. And I just want to apologize for it. I wish you could have come on a different day, like when we got the meat monster out or something.
Well, none of that showed through on the day that I was there. I've just felt you were in your typical mode and just, running around, making sure everything got done. That day, what stands out in my mind is the ego boost that I got because, the kind words that Jason said about the early days of Ain't It Cool aside, when we were doing Ain't It Cool stuff, we had the talk backers and we had, that kind of instantaneous feedback, but it's not like I would go out and get recognized anywhere. And I remember when you're like, oh, you should go meet Chase. He's one of our leads. And I went into the makeup room just to say hello or whatever. And he was staring at me like I'd fucking kicked his dog or something. And I was like, oh man, did I piss this kid off or something? Like, what's going on? And then he confessed that he was super nervous because he was a huge fan of my writing and my work at Ain't It Cool and all this stuff. And I was just like, okay. And I'm not used to getting that. So I was just like, okay, great. But it was the only time that I've ever seen anybody starstruck about me in my life. So,
that's Chase Williamson. He's a terrific actor, but yeah. He grew up on you. Eric, you and a couple of your buddies there made a real cultural impact that is, still being felt today. So at any rate, I apologize for the day that you did.
It's all right. You can make it up on the next one. So, well, Jason, there's a couple things I want to bring up with you before we dive into the meat of Misery here. One, I want to give you a chance to kind of pitch the new book and talk a little bit about that. But I also kind of want to dig into your just the insane amount of social media work that you're doing that is actually legitimate. And I hate this fucking word, but good content, and as much as I hate that word, I call it a video or something and it just doesn't sound right. But I can't tell you when I'm doom scrolling TikTok or something at, 2 a.m. trying to, get my brain to shut up and go to sleep. And I'll go through all these people trying to hawk, this is, if you put onions in plastic containers, you're leaching microfiber, plastics and all this stupid shit. And then you'll come in and go, here, let me sit you down for 3 minutes and give you a, did you know this video that is actually something I didn't know and well-researched and fascinating. So I don't know which one of those you want to tackle first, but those are two topics that are up on the table.
Well, the book is the title we gave already is I'm Starting to Worry About This Black Box of Doom. And the setup is that there's a young guy who is a rideshare driver and he meets a strange woman who offers him $200,000 in cash to give her an off the books ride across the country from LA area to Washington, D.C. And she has with her this big black box, steamer trunk size box, big enough that a person could crawl inside of it. And she says, but there are rules. You cannot look inside this box. Uh-huh. You cannot ask me what's in the box. And you must leave behind all devices, phone, laptop, GPS, navigator, anything that can be tracked has to stay behind. You can't tell anyone. If we're going, we go now. Mm-hmm. And so the two of them take off. Spoiler, he accepts the deal because, of course, he does. Some other people on the internet get wind of that trip and try to stop it because they suspect something terrible is about to happen and chaos ensues.
Ooh.
Any more than that would be a huge spoiler. Other than I do have to say for John Dice at the End fans, there's not like a vampire in the box. This is not a supernatural. It's not a supernatural horror story. It's a standalone novel. It is not part of any other series or universe. If you've never read any of my books, this is as good of a place to come in as any, other than the fact that it would be by far the most expensive option because it's brand new. But mm-hmm. if you want to read your first Jason Pardon novel and you are rich, this is perfect. Go right for it. Get the hardcover. It's probably $46.
You're very good at hooks, Jason. I don't know if you know that. You know, just these whole premises of, oh, here, let me explain to this thing, this setup, and now you want to know the whole fucking story. You are supernaturally good at that almost. So,
I had the same thought when I just read the log line on it. It sounds like a fantastic movie. And I'm so sure somebody's going to pay a lot of money to option it.
It's out there. It's with the guy at CAA. So we'll see. So anyway, the video stuff, at age 47 joined TikTok in the summer of 2022, almost exactly 2 years ago, maybe a little more than 2 years, because, I have been doing this for a really long time and I'm getting older and I think a lot of my readers are dying from old age. So it was, but to be serious, it was very clear. Like if you want to reach people, all of the text-based outlets, like Facebook was kind of dying out, or at least it felt like it. Twitter, I don't know what's going on there. And I'm somebody who does not put my face out there. I don't mm-hmm. do video. I'm not a YouTuber. I had never done any kind of video content, like unless reluctantly prior to 2022. And so I joined TikTok as one of the oldest people on the app, it felt mm-hmm. like, and just gave myself a crash course in how to do video and what to do with my face when I'm looking at a camera and what type of microphone to use.
And you taught yourself the Megan dance and then did that and became a superstar.
But see, that's the point. At the time, TikTok, that was the reputation, is that it is all like 13-year-old girls dancing. And then if you're a 47-year-old man on there, you go right on a watch list.
Right.
It's like, why are you on here watching, oh, she's 15 and in a bathing suit? It's like, no, that's for other 15-year-olds. That's not for you to look at. Right. It's But no, it turned out that was completely wrong. Guys like Hank Green or the mini Green brothers, Tom Green, all of the Greens were doing like very informative little videos. And also at the exact time I arrived, TikTok started demanding longer videos. And in fact, if you monetize on there, they will not pay if the video is under 1 minute.
Mm.
Because they realized that having an app where you have trained the people to scroll every 3 seconds, you can't show them ads because you've taught them not to look at anything for more than 3 seconds. So nobody would pay to put ads on there. So they tried to train people. So like a video on TikTok, you can upload up to 10 minutes now. And some of my biggest hits are 5+ minutes, which again, if you've not been on TikTok, that sounds very short. If you have been on there, a freaking 5-minute long video is like a movie that's 7.5 hours long. Like,
you're right. It's a David Lean movie for TikTok. Yeah.
Yeah, or a Zack Snyder cut. So now, like as of this recording, I have like 520,000 followers, and this is now by far the biggest audience I've had of anything I've ever done. Like the number of people who've watched my TikTok videos dwarfs the total number of people that read my cracked columns or that read my books, or anything else. This is the biggest reach I've had in my entire life, and it's been very strange. Occasionally I will get recognized in public and I don't like that. I'm somebody who's tried to stay anonymous for like the first decade of his career until that wasn't an option. But yeah.
What's your highest viewed video? Which one's that one? Do you know offhand?
Yeah, I have one that has almost 21 million views, but cumulatively the channel has almost 500 million.
Crazy.
That's
amazing. Hey, Eric, could we take a moment and just jump back to almost before social media when Jason was a senior editor at crack.com? And he did an essay that I I understand it has something like 25 million page views to this date. It's like about the harsh truths that'll make you a better person. I think that was the title of it or something like that. Could you tell us a little about that, Jason? Because it was a brilliant piece of philosophy, I thought.
Well, back in that era, in the 2010s, you could write a blog post that would go viral in the way that videos do now. Mm. That doesn't happen anymore. Nobody, because it was like a 4,000 word long essay that became super famous. Like it showed up on all of these aggregator sites like Reddit and all of the Reddit precursors. And yeah, I think when I left there, it had like 23 million page views or something like that. And it was only on two pages, but, and it was just basically what now is the type of like self-help advice that's aimed at young males. Only now they would have it mixed with a lot of like ugliness and stuff about woke politics or whatever, but it wasn't anything about that. It was just saying that if you are struggling and you feel like you don't have any self-esteem, I've always felt like the quickest way to get self-esteem is to do something
right
that you are proud of, that looking in the mirror and like saying, I am good enough. That may help some people. For me, just, I would get more out of getting out and cleaning the gutters, or, and now like Jordan Peterson would say, well, just clean your room. But it's the exact same principle, doing some tangible real world work that you can look at and say, that was dirty before and now it's clean and I did that. That's like the most therapeutic thing I know of. And that as just a life philosophy, I've not found many better than just saying, you're in a world full of people who need things. Like anytime you say, well, my life doesn't have purpose, you're surrounded by people who need something. There's an old person on your street who needs somebody to go get groceries for them. There's something, there's crap in your yard you can pick up. And that a lot of the, where people will just zone out on a sofa or a chair and stare at their phone, or at the time I wrote this would stare, like lose themselves in a video game for 16 straight hours. Like, that kind of just distraction eventually eats you alive, because that's what I experienced. So it was just a call to say, look, you're in a world that judges you by what you can do, and where people will judge you by what you can do for them, and where a lot of what partners will find attractive about you is what you can do, not necessarily how you look or how tall you are. Like if you are a short, ugly person, but you're dynamic and you can do stuff and you've got a million talents and you can play guitar and you can make a great pot of chili, like you've got all these cool little skills you've built up. That's kind of everything. And that's it. It's to me, it seemed very simple and very obvious. I wrote it as like a New Year's Day thing. Like, hey, it's 2010 or whatever year I wrote it. You know, like, let's make it our goal this year to learn something cool that will impress our friends, and we're going to build up our self-esteem that way. And it kind of became a movement.
Oh, that's wonderful. That is absolutely my experienced life as well. It's I've noticed that there's also something where I can talk myself out of action very easily. And all the times that I've just thrown that to the wind, or like there was a period of time where I got really into like, I need to drop some weight. I've been, you know, heavy my entire life. I've once again gained it all back in the meantime. But, you know, there was a period of time where, you know, I was like, okay, I'm exercising regularly. And if I thought about it, I would start dreading it. And if I started dreading it, I would put it off. And that had been my history. And the thing that kind of helped me in that little period of time where I actually did kind of get a little bit in shape was I would notice that really early on, I would just set my days. These are the days I exercise no matter what. And even if I just have to find, you know, 30 minutes, you know, at whatever point. And it, the second that the doom in my brain would start, I would just essentially go blank, almost into a fugue state, and just do it and just start it. And if I'd started it, then it was fine. But there is something psychological about just doing a thing. I think you fucking hit it right on the nose there. It's like, you know, once you start seeing the results of that, then then it becomes easier to take the next step and to be out, you know, out there. It's
listening to this, Eric, I'm thinking through my friends, like, which are the ones that have taken that to heart? And we have a common friend who I think is the epitome of that, which is Tim League.
Yeah.
You know, one time I'm over there, he's, I'm doing beekeeping now.
Yeah.
He's always got something interesting and fascinating to talk about because he's always achieving.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a difference. And, you know, not to, you know, to get too, you know, oh, it's all a state of mind. There's a lot of things that can work against, you know, that becoming a reality for a lot of people. But, you know, I think that psychological hurdle is definitely a big one. And I think there's a reason why that piece resonated is basically what I'm trying to say. Cool. Well, do you want to start digging into some Stephen King stuff? I think it might be good. I think a nice segue into the Stephen King talk is the idea of a pseudonym. But I want to put a pin in that because usually before we get in that, we ask our guests what their Stephen King origin story is. So I want to get that out of the way first. And I think then we'll dive into the pseudonym aspect.
Well, he was I think a lot of 80s kids, he was the first author I got into. And I think it's a thing where the grownups of that era maybe didn't know, like they knew the books were horror, but they probably didn't know how graphic they were. But you could be in fifth grade and see a copy of It on everybody's desk. Like yeah. We were all reading it. So being however old I was when I started reading it, yeah, again, it in theory was way beyond my grade level, but it didn't matter. This was my, you know, I wrote Cosmic Horror as my first book with my own like little spin on it. But even the humor in that book is very common to what you would see in Stephen King novels. So
right.
There's no question. I was raised on Stephen King. I grew up in a small town that did not have a bookstore. We had a library that did not have a ton of books in it. So the books that were accessible to you back in those days, again, this is pre-Amazon, pre-everything, was the paperbacks they had at the pharmacy or at the grocery store.
Right.
And those were it was Tom Clancy, Stephen King, that, you know, Dean Koontz, it was that stuff. There was no such thing as becoming like a fan of manga or something in that right. era. There was no like discovering, like, you know, even if I had known at the time who H.P. Lovecraft was, you're not going to find that in the little rack at Kroger, that you would find Stephen King. And that taught me my love of reading. And I, all those years later, when I finally started writing, you know, for myself, it's not a surprise to me that's where I started. Now, I stopped reading. Like there was a point in my life where I read everything he released as soon as it came out.
Yeah.
Because it got to a point where I had my own money. I knew when the stuff was going to come out in hardcover. I would go, I'd go the next town over to a Target because they were the only ones that had new hardcovers. But I broke off around when he had the car accident.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in 1999.
Yep.
And not because I was mad at him for having the cars. Like, I prefer authors who don't get hit by cars. No, it's just there was a break in his publishing, and that was like some life changes, I think, around that time. And I kind of drifted away. And everything that came out after that, it was like, I don't know. It was like a newer, different era. So I didn't keep up as well, but then read the big ones like, you know, the Kennedy assassination novel.
Yeah, 11/22/63. And yeah.
Great book.
Yeah.
But Misery is right in the heart of when I was reading everything and being dazzled by everything.
Yeah, no, you're not wrong. There's an era. I mean, some of his 90s stuff is way more complicated than what he had done beforehand. And I didn't, you know, I was the same thing starting around Needful Things, I think was the latest of his books to come out when I first was like, okay, I'm reading everything this guy's done. And you know, that means I was getting the stuff like Gerald's Game and, you know, some of his just more complicated, you know, works. It just didn't feel as like pulpy and fun as an It or Salem's Lot or whatnot. You know what I mean? This one's about the haunted car. This one's about the, you know, dog with rabies. It's like they became more complex. And it wasn't until doing the show, actually, that and going back and revisiting stuff like Rose Matter and and other, you know, books of that era. Whereas, like, I can actually have a little bit of an appreciation for, like, what he was doing, and, like, just for whatever reason, you know, kind of seeing that next stage of his writing career. But there, that post-accident stuff is kind of rough. Those are the books that are really tough to kind of get through, the Dreamcatchers and whatnot. And it really was, I think, 11/22/63 where he found his mojo back. You know, that's where he got it back, and where you read 11/22/63 and you're like, this is up there with the best things he, you know, he wrote in his 80s heyday. But if you haven't read any of his more recent stuff, I would highly, highly, highly recommend Revival. That's a title that that we champion a lot here at the show. And it's one that's kind of the redheaded stepchild of his. It's like pure existential dread story. It's never been adapted, so it doesn't really have that boost. But it kind of came out in that period where people were coming back to King, and I think it's one of his more overlooked ones.
I've not read it, but I definitely will.
It's for all the criticism that King gets about not sticking the landing on his books, this one is the exception to to that rule. It is one of the things where you might be reading it going, okay, this is fine, this is okay, this is pretty good, like I'm interested, but, you know, I don't know. And then you get to the end, and like what he does with the end, you go, this is the reason why this book exists, and this is the reason why it's going to stick with me forever. So not to build it up too much, now you're going to read it and go, yeah, I thought it was just fine.
I'm going to put it on my list.
Oh, I love it. It's the
next to Big Box of Doom.
Yes, of course. Everybody read, you know, Big Box of Doom first, and then read Revival, which is its own Big Box of Doom. Or Black Box of Doom. Sorry, I keep throwing big in there for some
reason. Right, you've corrupted me now, Eric.
I know. That's my new goal, is I'm just going to make everybody think that this is the Berenstain Bears all over again. We're going to Mandela effect your book before it even comes out.
Multiple people who work at the publisher have referred to it as Big Box of Doom. And I don't know why. And I don't know if it's because it's like more alliterative or something where it just flows better, but that clearly should have been the title. Because they keep, like, I can look at email subject lines where, like, my editor has written, Big Box of Doom. And I think that's, like, the internal title at the publisher that they, because that's what they've accidentally been calling it for the last year. I don't know why. There's got to be some language thing where people, because you guys are not the first to make that mistake, and it's interesting.
Mm. Well, is it too late to change the title?
I can check, but it probably.
But you know, the second you change the title, then everybody's going to be like, Black Box of Doom. No, wait, it's Big Box of Doom.
Well, the box isn't that big. Like, it's big if you had to carry it. I don't know. I guess if I say Big Box of Doom, I'm picturing a much bigger box. But we can do another episode about just that.
Do it. So let's talk about Misery. So we had... I'm really glad you picked this title, and we had kind of a bit of a long runway on this. So... I got to revisit Misery, which is something that I haven't gotten to do for the show before. We've talked a lot about the Rob Reiner adaptation on the show, but we haven't really dug into the book as much. I was really excited to go back and dive back into this book. And one thing we were kind of talking about off air was the whole idea of pseudonyms. You kind of became known in publishing under a different name. You know, I wrote for, you know, sent from the age of 17 to 37, 38. I, you know, 20 plus years writing under the name Quint on Ain't It Cool News. And of course, King has the Richard Bachman pseudonym, which ties into Misery. So I don't know what the question is in there, but I think it's really interesting that this is all, you know, all of us are kind of talking about this, you know, right now, when we all have our own kind of like pseudonym backstory. Do you have any thoughts on the benefits of pseudonyms, maybe as it comes to somebody like Stephen King, who originally was going to write this as one of his Bachman books?
I never fully understood why, because he started writing as under the pseudonym Richard Bachman very early. Yeah. It was just a few years into his career. And I've seen him talk about it. And I think on some level, I don't know if he just wanted to test himself to see if people were just buying his books. Because if you bought a Stephen King book back then, his name was like 2/3 of the cover. And then the title of the book was like an afterthought.
Yeah.
Because they knew that the people were not shopping for, oh, it's a book about a possessed dog. No, we're shopping for whatever the Stephen King thing is this year. And so I don't know if he wanted to see if his stuff could do well, because he had said that it did okay. It sold, you know, like tens of thousands of copies, but it didn't do Stephen King numbers. And it is my understanding that he absolutely wanted Misery to be a Richard Bachman novel, and that he thought Misery would put Richard Bachman separately on the New York Times bestseller list.
Right.
But there were some of the short stories and stuff in the novellas released under that name that I can see why, because they were more crime type stuff, or they didn't have an element of supernatural horror, but others were just straight up Stephen King stories. And as I think you mentioned earlier, that it's extremely obvious this is a Stephen King novel.
Yes.
If you read it, if you taped over the name, because it's not like he's, you know, a style that's only familiar to a few academics. He was one of the most famous people in the world in the 80s. You know, like he was a superstar, and he had directed films by that point and had done all the talk shows. Everybody knew his face. He had a very distinctive look. So
yeah, his American Express commercial. Yeah.
Oh yeah. He was everywhere. Like people, I don't know if people realize he was like far more famous than J.K. Rowling is now.
Yeah.
Like in terms of just turning up everywhere, his name was synonymous with horror. So I don't know why the overarching reason he wanted to write as a separate person, but I absolutely understand why he wanted to write Misery under a pseudonym. And in fact, if he had not had a pseudonym, I could see him demanding that Misery be released under a pseudonym, because this is a little bit of him lashing out at his own fans in the form of a story in which a fan keeps him hostage and forces him to do work he doesn't want to do. And that's one reason why this book is so incredible, because it's coming from a deeply personal place. And I think from an angry place, and in a way that he may not have been able to do if he had known from the start this is going to have his own giant name on it.
I can fill in a little bit on the Bachman side of things, just based on the research that I've done. You get Stephen King, you ask Stephen King this question at multiple points over the course of his career, you get a different answer. That's probably why it's kind of hard to pin down what the actual truth is. But, you know, I think two things rise to the top and that are consistent throughout the decades. One of them is, yes, his name was becoming the thing selling books, and there was something in him wanting to know if it was the words or just his name, and if he could release a book under another name, if it would do as well, if people didn't know. He said that multiple times, and I believe him when he says it, but I think the real truth is more of a boring publisher spat thing, where King is nothing but prolific, you know, if he's not prolific. He is, before he hit it big, he had all this other writing, and predominantly, I think almost everything that was a Bachman story before Thinner was written before he became famous in some way. The Long Walk he wrote as a college student. So he had all this material, and he wanted to put it out. And his publisher essentially said, no, you're going to wear out your welcome. You're going to overexpose yourself. You can't put out more than one book a year. And so I think that honestly, more than anything, he was just excited to get his unpublished stuff out, and he didn't want to wait. So my guess is that's like 65% of it, and 35% of it is exactly what he said about, just also curious to see if it would sell. And then of course he got discovered, you know, when Thinner came out, and of course Thinner became a giant seller because everybody knew it was a Stephen King book. And I think it was the first of the Bachman books that came out in the hardcover, and it was like a perfect storm. But I mean, I think you're exactly right when it comes to Misery, in that there's no way that this book comes out and people don't get it. You know, now this is what we were kind of talking about off mic before we started recording. You know, you read this book, it is so thoroughly Stephen King in every aspect. There's a writer, main character, the way that he dives into, you know, you get glimpses at the story he's writing, which is exactly what the structure he used in The Body, which became Stand By Me. You know, it's like you get all these glimpses of, you know, Stephen King's style. It is so clear this is a Stephen King book. And, you know, I don't know, I'm kind of glad that Bachman got found out, because Misery kind of became like, I don't know, something of a keystone Stephen King title, where, you know, where you kind of, the way The Shining was before it, where it's like you're getting a glimpse, you know, really at the author himself and what he's grappling with, in terms of addiction, in terms of, you know, grappling with his fame. You know, I think that this is such a Stephen King throwing himself in the middle of the story thing that it becomes completely inescapable that it's a Stephen King story.
Eric, when you said that word grappling, I rewatched the movie before the show and read the book, and I have a lot of comments. I want to go into that comparison later. But the grappling of watching James Caan fight to the death with Kathy Bates, it came to my thing, that's a writer wrestling with his demons. It was poetically put together in that way in the film, certainly. But maybe we could do a little shift into comparison of book versus movie, because I want to bring up the irony that I came across in this conversation, or this thought before the conversation. I think that we know that the movie is great. It's Oscar winning, you know, great, great acting, directing, and all that stuff. But the book is really good. I never read the book. Watched the movie. And while I'm thinking, I'm watching it, I go, oh, there's Hollywood. They put a movie out, you know, and it kind of sucks up all the energy, and nobody ever goes to read the book. And then I thought, oh, wait a minute. Don, didn't you do that with John Dies at the End? Because we put the movie out, and a lot of people probably never went and saw, visited the book, because they figure, oh, well, it's all in the movie. But it never can all be in the movie, and it's certainly, this is a case where it isn't. It's so much more visceral. It's so much more shocking. The nature of the Annie character, her psychology or pathology, is so deep and rich and frightening in the book, and the savagery of the book, it's just great. And it, you know, you compare them side by side, and the book just is outstanding.
Yeah. This episode is supported by FX's Grotesquerie, a new series from executive producer Ryan Murphy. Heinous crimes unsettle a small community, and the local detective feels these atrocities are eerily personal, as if someone or something is taunting her. Starring Niecy Nash-Betts, Courtney B. Vance, Leslie Manville, and Travis Kelsey, FX's Grotesquerie premieres September 25th on FX. Stream on Hulu. Now back to the show. I mean, listen, just flat out, Kathy Bates, that performance is an all-timer. You know, there's a reason she won the Oscar. There's a reason why, you know, she's like, I think the only Stephen King thing. His stuff has been nominated a few times. She's the only Oscar win for any Stephen King story, which is kind of mind-blowing when you consider how many incredible people have adapted his work and made like all-timer movies, from Stand By Me and Shawshank and even The Shining, which I know The Shining, back when it was released, was considered a laugh fest, and, you know, it was a cheesy movie, nobody liked it. Now it's a masterpiece. But you know, when you kind of look at everybody that's had their hand in it, it's crazy that Kathy Bates is the one to walk away with an Oscar, and well deserved. It's an incredible performance, but there's something about the way Annie is written that is so much more unpredictable than the Rob Reiner William Goldman version of the character. Not saying that the Annie's walk in the park and on the cinema screen, but there's something different, and it might just be because you're internalizing it. It might be because she's in your head in a way that she can't be on the screen when you're reading it. But I found like reading it now, when she enters her shutdown states, you know,
which didn't even, that was not really touched. It was just lightly touched on in the movie.
Right.
And yet it was so profound in the book.
It was like the warning shot that something fucked up was going to happen. And it puts you instantly on edge whenever Paul is noticing her withdrawing into herself and kind of the self-mutilation stuff she was doing, hitting herself, like tearing chunks out of her forehead, you know. I mean, it's, you know, it becomes way more unpredictable and thus way scarier in the book there. And she also, you know, as one of the things that is always pointed out, that she doesn't use a sledgehammer to hobble him in the book. She uses an axe and legitimately cuts off a foot, but she also cuts off one of his thumbs. You know, it's like it becomes way more of a, you know, pieces of him are being taken by this person, which I guess you could look at thematically and you know,
relationship. We have to give credit to the filmmakers, because, you know, in a feature film, you have a finite shelf life, and it's really the shelf life of how long the ass can sit in the seat. And that's about 2 hours. You don't want to go much beyond that. And they distilled the story into the 2 hours very well. And obviously that's why it got that. But I want to take a poll among the two of you. What are you thinking about like a 4-hour miniseries of misery?
I think it would far, far more accurately convey the feeling of the book and what he went through. Because for people who've only, I think some of the listeners probably have only seen the film and have not read the book spends so much time inside Paul. That's the protagonist's name, right? Paul Sheldon.
Yeah. Paul Sheldon. Yeah.
It spends so much time inside Paul's head, because she keeps abandoning him and disappearing for long stretches. And at one point she throws him down into the cellar and leaves him there for, I think, days. But he, as the pain pills wear off, and then he describes the pain and then describes the thirst because he has no water. And it is so unflinching and so drawn out that the whole point is that there's nothing happening. Like, that's what's scary. If this was being shown on film, it would not be anything. It would just be a guy, and maybe you could have some like overdubbed narration that's very, you know, over the top, but you can't convey it in the same way. I think you could make a miniseries that is far more true to the book and that everyone would hate.
Probably. It'd be the Mick Garris, The Shining all over again, probably, because the original movie is so... it's so iconic in its way. But I think that that's exactly the reason why it could exist and should exist. Justin, you know, I might have my opinions on the TV version of The Shining, a way to tell that story. But I'm fascinated that it exists because it's a real peek into a direct, like, one-to-one adaptation in the way the Kubrick movie isn't, you know? So there's a reason for it to be there. You know, I don't think that a miniseries could top the Rob Reiner movie, but I think that it could give it
room to breathe. Some of the scenes they left out.
Yeah.
The riding mower. Oh my God. How could they leave that on the floor?
There's also the length of time that passes, right? Which is something that doesn't quite translate. You get the time's passing, it goes from snowy and the snow's melting, but that's kind of the ticking clock, is when the snow's melting, that's when his time's up in the movie. And they essentially figure out a way around it, they being Stephen King, figures out a way around that in the book, and it's almost like, what, a year that he is held hostage there in the book. And I think having that passage of time deepened the horror of the situation a little bit too. So I think you could do that in a miniseries. Whether or not that could test the audience's patience, I don't know, but there's a reason for something like that to exist. So I'm pro the idea, especially if you get some really interesting folks into those roles. You know, I think that they're both very meaty roles.
Well, the time passage is so important in the book because their relationship changes very gradually, because there's an entire twist in the book that kind of is not conveyed, because in the film, she kind of becomes like a slasher villain toward the end.
Right.
But in the book, the whole thing is that initially he sees Annie as this very like dumb, like she's just watching old reruns and she's like eating Cheetos and she's got like low class tastes, and he has such disdain for her because, you know, reading these crappy romance novels, that again, the point that author is ashamed that this is what he's become known for, are right. These misery books. And then as time goes on, when the police start to come by and they discover his card, things like that, she gets involved in like a cat and mouse game with the police and consistently wins.
Yep.
And realizes, oh, she's gotten away with crimes before. She's really smart. Like, she's been surviving with nobody out here by herself, with all the neighbors think she's a killer, and she has no support system, no family, no friends, nothing. And she does it. And so there's this begrudging respect. And it's like, oh, my challenge is not like trying to escape a wild animal. It's trying to escape this very intelligent person who has nothing else to do but hold me hostage all day.
Yeah, no, it definitely is illuminated that she's kind of the Teflon Don, right? Of this, where everything bad that could happen to her, it doesn't stick. Right. And it leads to this feeling of like, there's nothing I can do to fight. And they're like, Paul kind of gives up at a certain point. And what's really interesting about it, and the thing that I think really drives the back half of this book to me, is how into the writing he gets, how the writing becomes his reason to live. And so this thing that he had been shying away from and, you know, just kind of thinking lesser of, in the book, he doesn't burn the fucking manuscript at the end. He burns a fake one because he's already done that once. So like in the book, they make sure to, he hides the real book under the bed, and then he burns a fake one to fake out Annie to enact his revenge. But, you know, he becomes, he falls in a weird way, falls back in love with this, you know, with this writing, and kind of comes to terms with himself as this guy that can write populist fiction. Again, a very Stephen King thing, right? You can't help but look at that and not go, you know, is this Stephen King reminding himself that he can write these horror things? He doesn't have to, you know, earn the respect of critics. Like, this is just whatever he writes that his fans respond to, you know, he's doing it right. You know, I don't know if there's something deeper there, or if it just happened to, you know, that was best dramatically in the moment while King was writing.
It's my understanding that it played out like this. Stephen King hit the scene in, I think, 1974 with Carrie, and that became a spectacular runaway bestseller. And then he had a choice to make, that his second book was going to be Salem's Lot, which, again, he had multiple books finished, I think, before he started getting these book deals. But I think there was a conversation with his agent, like, if your second runaway bestseller is also horror, you're kind of now a horror author. And I don't think Stephen King ever wanted to be a horror author. I don't think that's what he set out to do. I think he fell into it the way many of us fall into our jobs. Like, the thing you're good at and the thing you like doing is not necessarily the same thing. So before he became a big time author, he was teaching a class on sci-fi and fantasy. And I think fantasy is what he wanted to write. So in 1982, he writes The Dark Tower, which is just straight up a fantasy series. Like, that's, they've just replaced the swords with six guns, but otherwise it's the lore and the castles and the knights and the chivalry and the magic. In 1984, he publishes a pure sword and sorcery book called The Eyes of the Dragon. And apparently the fans were very mean to him about it, because today it's common to, if you publish so much as a photo of your breakfast on social media, you will have people telling you to commit suicide. Right. At the time, when your fans have to write you out a letter in a piece of paper and mail it to your house to give you the bad feedback, it has to hurt so much more. And they a lot of people bought Eyes of the Dragon. It's like, well, where's the freaking vampires? Where's the werewolf? Is this what's possessed in this castle? And he turned around and wrote Misery. It was published in 1987, right after that. And I think this, it started out, Misery was originally planned to be like a novella. I think he thought it'd be about 30,000 words long. And I think he was just going to write this thing where he vented on these fans who do not see him as a person, but rather see him as a machine where they can push a button and horror pops out.
Right.
And I mean, so he writes this perfect metaphor of a fan who is keeping him alive. Again, Annie is feeding him, clothing him, giving him everything he needs, but at the same time is absolutely holding him hostage.
Yeah. It's so interesting because I'm kind of obsessed with how King views Misery here. Not Misery, the book, and Annie Wilkes specifically as the antagonist here, because it is so clear to anybody from the outside that that is exactly what that metaphor you brought up is exactly right on the money. That feels right. You ask Stephen King this, though. He says Annie Wilkes has never been about my fandom. It's been about addiction. She, in this book, is heavily about addiction. This is the first book he wrote when he got sober. And he said that Annie Wilkes is a stand-in for cocaine or, you know, alcoholism. Like they're my number one fan. And so much of the book is about Paul Sheldon's addiction to these painkillers. And this is something King would then later face. There's a lot of prescience in this too, because the injuries that Paul Sheldon have are almost exactly like the injuries King would have with that van accident, you know, when he got hit by the van, and the recuperation and having to relearn, you know, to, you know, his legs are never going to work exactly the same again. And he got addicted to Oxy when he, you know, when he was on the pain meds after the accident. So in a weird way, it became a little bit of foreshadowing, but you talk to him and he says that Annie Wilkes is not about fandom at all. It's about addiction and, you know, this thing keeping him addicted. And listen, he's the writer. He has the ultimate, you know, voice on it. You know, you got to take his word for it, but it's so hard for me to read this book and not see the fandom element to it.
No, I think he is lying, because otherwise fans will think that he's portraying them all as being psychopaths, but you have to read the book to understand. The book is about him working through that hurt, because she is the one that makes him write another Misery novel. And it's really good. Like, he realizes, oh, this is actually, because she also forces him to, like, he can't drink, or he gets clean basically in the course of being in her care, and suddenly is writing twice as much as what he did back when he was drunk all the time, and thinks about the supposed award-winning novel that she made him burn, and kind of reflects back on it. It's like, it was kind of just a pretentious piece of garbage. Like, it was me showing off, trying to earn the love of these critics. And he, like, that writing the last Misery book that she makes him write, that winds up saving his life. That gives him a reason to go on, or gives him a reason to get better. And, you know, she basically forces him to stay there until he finishes it. But it's like, and this part's in the movie where he says, you know, in some ways she saved me. I would have drank myself to death or done something, you know, like I was heading toward a bad place, and she kind of, not on purpose, but put me back on the path. And
right.
The therapeutic power of writing something that people actually enjoy and realizing that's okay. Like, that's the journey, that initially he sees this person as a monster, but it feels like there are too many stereotypes up front that an author would have about not all of their fans, but maybe the fans that you don't enjoy running into, the ones that are too into the work, or they're weird about it.
Right.
And I don't think there's anything.
Or start a podcast about it.
I don't think there's anything.
Or would appear on a podcast about it.
But there's anything ugly or shameful in that, because at the end, it's him working through that idea and coming out the other side and saying, no, I was not a good person before. This was, you know, like a lot of stories, that winds up being like his purgatory, where it's that experience kind of leaves him a better person at the end.
Well, it was an impossible challenge that King faced him with. Number one, we all know, because all of us are writers on this call, that what a challenge is to finish your work. And to imagine having a death sentence over your head when you publish the last word is amazing to me.
Yeah.
That's an incredible amount of pressure. But also not so much mentioned is that Paul is forced to write two narratives at once. He needs to service her and finish Misery, whatever it is, the return of Misery. And he also needs to formulate his escape plan or right. Write that out. So he's working at two ends consequently with this death penalty hanging over his head.
And the fact that he falls back in love with writing during this whole process is one of the most interesting angles here, you know, because you've heard stories. There's the whole, you know, North Korean dictators bringing in their favorite filmmakers to make them their own private, you know, giant monster movies and stuff. You know, it's like that shit happens in real life. But, you know, can you imagine being like abducted from like, you know, somebody in like Eastern Europe grabs you, Don, at some point because he's a huge Phantasm fan. And then he just funds you like the most amazing like Phantasm sequel that you could ever possibly imagine. A part of you would be like, this is actually pretty cool. I'm actually getting to do something that I've, you know, like I'm falling in love with my world again. You know what I mean? It's like, I feel like that there's a really complicated and interesting angle that
especially if you have the millions it would take to mount it.
There's the joy of it. And just the fact that, you know, this is something that he's been kind of born to do is, you know, that writing is his escape. If this had really happened to Stephen King, I can imagine him doing the same thing where, you know, the writing is the escape that he needs.
Well, I think it's interesting too that because this was originally, as I said, was going to be just a novella or whatever 30,000 words qualifies as,
right?
A long short story, whatever. And it was going to end with Annie getting the book and then binding it in Paul's skin.
Yep.
Because with short stories, like a lot of Stephen King's shorts are like that. They're just short and mean, and they have like a grotesque, horrible ending. And you can do that in a short story. It's just. Yeah. But as he was writing it, he found that Paul, this character, was surprising him, that he was more resourceful, that he wanted to live, that he was, you know, and then he found that Annie, that again, in the short story, I'm sure was just supposed to be this almost demonic, insane presence, that she wound up being a very complex person, and that these books fill an emotional need in her life that she doesn't have any other outlet for. Like he just found as he wrote it. And so writing Misery and writing it out, not as this short, mean little rant against his fans, in my opinion, but it becoming this whole thing, the writing of that embodies that metaphor. I'm going to dive into what this means. I'm going to dive into who these two people are and dive into this relationship and think about how he could get out of this. And it's kind of like he realized that relationship was more complex than maybe he thought when he started writing it, whether, right. And if it's metaphorical, then it's like realizing, okay, yeah, this is an interesting codependent thing. And that maybe I didn't appreciate, but I don't know. I've always felt like it's the fact that it became a full length novel. It's him working through it. And I think the fact that it's so visceral is due to how personal he, because again, if you were somebody who didn't know the order that things happened in Stephen King's life, you would immediately assume this was the book he wrote after the car accident.
Right.
Like you would say, oh, this of course is him writing about what it's like to look down at the bottom half of your body and see it ruined. And then to be totally dependent on another person to take care of you and that, you know, trying to maintain some sort of dignity or anything. And it's like, no, he wrote this 12 years before. You mentioned very briefly, none of us appreciate how weird that is,
mm-hmm.
how similar the injuries were, the mangled and pulped legs. Like, yeah, that's so strange.
Yeah, it's odd. Yeah. And it's, you know, again, prescient. And the fact that I bet you if he went back and read it now, and I'm sure he has, I bet you'd be like, I was right on the money on how that felt. You know, it's like you read that and you can't help, you know, with, you know, 2020 eyes looking at Misery if you revisit it, and you kind of put yourself in the Stephen King's headspace in 99 and 2000 as he's recovering from this. It's So there are two things that I want to bring up before we bring this chat in for a landing. And that are two ways that William Goldman deviated from the book. And I think that they are both really smart choices. One of them is building up a brand new character, Buster, who is the old sheriff in the town, you know, that is kind of on the hunt, and being able to cut away to outside the house. So I think just from a filmmaking standpoint, it lets the audience breathe a little bit and gives them a procedural to follow while all this other stuff's going on. I don't think it works necessarily on the written page. I think that this is purely a great cinematic addition. Because I think on the written page, the whole point of it is that once you're with Paul Sheldon, you're with Paul Sheldon, and you are in that room with him until he gets out. Right. And I think that if you give him a way to get out of that room, or give the reader a way to get out of that room, it lessens the effectiveness of the book. So
yes,
I understand why King didn't do that. But I think for a movie, it is such a great choice, and Richard Farnsworth is so fucking likable, you know, and the way that, you know, he's working with his wife is his deputy, and Frances Sternhagen, like, they are just so great together that it just gives the movie a little bit of a pressure relief, right? So you can relieve that tension just a little bit when you're with them, and then you can go back in with the Paul and Annie story.
Well, anything Richard Farnsworth was in he was amazing, especially the fact that he started off as a stuntman and then was, you know, basically drafted into acting in his like last 15 years and just became this celebrated character actor. Also, by the way, his son, Diamond Farnsworth, was a very talented stunt performer himself, and also appeared in The Beastmaster.
Oh, well, there you go. I knew there must have been a connection to Don. All roads lead back to Don Coscarelli at some point. But yeah, so there's that aspect that I like to throw on the table. And also, there's one thing that they do that I love, and it's something that, again, I don't think they could have done in the book, although I love the dynamic here, and that is Paul's plan to poison Annie with his pain pills, right? And to maybe overdose her, or at least knock her out to the point where he can make good an escape. I love that the movie spends so much time building this up. He's slowly saving the pills. He's got this plan, you know, and he does everything right. And just by fucking chance, she happens to knock over the thing, and you watch this thing, which has been built up for 15 fucking minutes of screen time, by the way. It's not like, oh, this is an idea I came up with in the last scene and it fails. But the fact that you spent, just in cinematic language, them spending so much time with the plan is telling the audience, okay, this is the plan. This is how he's going to get out. Right.
And that was some of the brilliance of James Caan in that moment when the glass crashes to the table. They just linger on his face where he's like, he can't believe that it happened. He doesn't know what the fuck he's going to do now. And he has to respond to her. They lingered on that moment. It was great.
It's a wonderful piece of acting. That look on his face is an all-timer thing, because he can't show any reaction to it. And again, praising Kathy Bates, and we've talked about this, I think, in previous episodes, but, you know, I think Kathy Bates being such a, the Annie Wilkes character requires a big eyeball-catching performance. And James Caan, I think, is doing just as great work, but his work isn't as big. So I think people kind of don't look at just how well he's pulling off of this very internal character in the same presence as this, lady, you know, screaming cock-a-doody and, you know, and having this wonderful, you know, drawing the eyes kind of performance.
And I think I've heard other people point out that you may be shocked to find out that Kathy Bates is only like 5'3" in real life, because in the movie, she's always just looming over him as, like, you know, and in the book, she's described as just this big woman, like strong, like a big farm woman. It's, and like, she can pick him up like it's nothing. And she conveys, you know, and I know a lot of it's just perspective, the fact that he's lying down, but that she always seems like a physical overmatch to him. And that's kind of, in her performance and the way it's shot, but, you know, in real life, she's just a small little person. But also there's a thing she does. I remember not liking this movie when I first saw it.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Because of her performance. Because at the time, and remember, people don't necessarily know, Kathy Bates was unknown at this time. She did theater work. But she gave this weird, what to me seemed like a weird robotic, unnatural performance. And she would do like some of the monologues and she's standing very stiffly. Now, when I look at it, one, it's incredibly scary because she's a little bit off in all of her mannerisms. But two, I think she's acting in the style she would have seen in those serials, the movie serials that she talked about, where they're like from the 1940s and you didn't have the naturalistic type of acting. And I think she in that performance is trying to imply that she learned how to be a person by watching those movies. And so it's affecting like this very, you know, but it just comes off as being slightly unearthly or something. It's like, it's such a great performance that now I see why she won the Academy Award. But at the time, you know, you read a book and the book plays in your mind and you want the movie to just be exactly that. And right. I guess I had been picturing, I guess someone more dangerous is what I'm trying to say, but it's so understated the way she lets the danger out a little bit at a time. Now I realize it's masterful.
There's definitely a grossness to the Annie that's in the book. I mean, the very first thing that we, you know, read in the book is the resuscitation, the mouth breathing stuff, the CPR that's going on. Is Paul becoming aware of that? And just the way that he describes the taste of her breath and how just it was everything he could do to keep from vomiting and how sickly it was. And yeah, there's definitely a grosser element to the Annie in the books where, you know, that's not what it reads like in the movie. In the movie, you know, you get very much this gradual realization that, oh shit, you know, this isn't right. It's not that the phone lines are down. It's not that, you know, that there's a blizzard that's keeping me trapped here. Like there's a, I think that from the, you know, launch in the movie, the dictate was, or the mandate was to have her start off as unthreatening as possible and then gradually become more and more threatening as we spend time with her. Which again works very well for the movie, but it's definitely a different vibe than the book.
And is there a better metaphor for what he's talking about here than when he is basically dying in the snow and the thing that wakes him up is the fact that this he's been being given mouth to mouth by someone with horrible breath and like he tastes the horrible diet she's been eating.
Yeah.
And the idea that he is revived from consciousness so he won't have to ingest any more of that. So the idea of the fan saves you, but also their breath smells bad.
Right.
That is so on the nose and so beautiful. Cause that's, if you've not read the book, that's the very first thing that happens is he's climbing out of unconsciousness while someone is pushing horrible breaths into his mouth. And from that point on, you know, if you're reading this book, you already can sense how horrible things are about to become. Mm-hmm.
So, gentlemen, do you have any final thoughts? Is there anything else you want to touch on before we wrap up this episode? Is there any other element of this that you want to focus on?
I mentioned it before. I want to see that miniseries, and let's get that gal who started Baby Reindeer to play Annie. And
yeah,
package.
Nice. Who do you see as your Paul? If you were making this, Don,
really good. You have to have somebody with gravitas and dignity and thought.
Somebody that's willing to play pathetic, that they're willing to play like that there. Because that's what's scary is that it's in the beginning, it's like, oh, this person is totally incapable of affecting their situation at all.
Right.
So like The Rock probably would not play it the right way.
The Rock as Annie Wilkes would be an interesting choice.
No. In a wig.
In but a wig and a muumuu, The Rock shows up.
Not to derail this with a total tangent, but the relationship Annie has with art is the same relationship that makes people think that AI novels will be a thing. Because thanks to technology, very soon that hypothetical person could just say into her phone, write me a new misery book. I'm unhappy that she's dead. Write me a new one. Because we get into that a little bit where he starts pounding out some piece of crap and she gives it back to him and says, no, write it good. Like, I need you to surprise me. This can't be, it needs to make sense. It's got to be anchored in the reality of the universe. Is like, no, I don't just want you to tell me what I want to hear. I want to feel scared and nervous. And I want to worry that she's going to die again. I want, like, so she's simultaneously demanding he write something very specific. I need you to write me another misery novel where she comes back from the dead, but also fussing with him about, well, no, it's got to be fair. It's got to be logically consistent. Like, this is what AI probably will never be able to do for you, right? Because it can crap out another, it could write a misery sequel where Paul gets trapped there again due to very poor planning on his part. He gets trapped in that house a second time. But in terms of writing something that the computer that spits out the novel has never been an addict. The computer that spits out the novel has never been in chronic pain. It's not drawing on the deep well of insecurities and body horror and everything else that the real flesh and blood human Stephen King was when he wrote this book. But there are people who are fans like Annie, who this is what they want. It's like, yes, someday I will just be able to tell this computer to render me a new Avengers movie. And it'll be full of fun and quips that the computer figured out by scraping other people's stories off the internet. And that this is all I wanted to be on demand. It's like, you don't understand what you're getting out of the art. You think it can do that. It really can't.
Jason, that's why this movie was so deep. I mean, the book was so deep, though, and so surprising that it turned out that her criticism was just quite intelligent and right on, and it was in a way, it's probably something that Paul's been looking for. Yet she's also a freak, so
yeah, but she's probably the best editor he's had in a long time, because he's portrayed as somebody who is so famous. And this the series, I think in the movie they say it's been 8 books. I don't know how many it was in the novel, but he's been so famous and is so deep into this series that no, his editor probably can't tell him anything. They probably get it. It's like, you've done it again. Yeah. We're going to get this. We're going to print off 4 million of these and they're going to sell the first week. Because why? Like, well, you know what you're doing. It's like, well, no, here's somebody who cares more about this character than you do. She cares more about this franchise and about this universe than you do. Like, she has memorized little details that he had to be reminded of because, you know, this is just one part of her life, but she reads these books over and over and over again. It's a great little unexpected turn, because you would think as an audience, well, he'll be able to just pound out something and that'll satisfy her until he can get healthy enough to escape. But it's immediately, she's like, no, I need you to write your best book, not just a book. And it's great. Cause yeah, her criticism is dead on.
It's a damning critique. It's a damning look at the state of modern fandom here, that Annie Wilkes is a good example of a fan that knows what she wants and knows what she doesn't want. Because modern day fans, I think that you're a lot of the harshest critics out there. And they may just be amplified by social media and Twitter and Reddit and whatnot. And this might not be fandom on the whole. God, I hope it isn't. But when you see these people that go after, say, the Disney Star Wars movies, and then like there's this one very prominent account that's been hypercritical of all the Disney Star Wars stuff, been labeled misogynist and all this stuff because they're always attacking the ladies and the people of color. One of those kind of fans. Then they put out their own, like, this is what it should be. And they did an AI. I don't know if you guys have seen this, but they've done like an AI attempt at, like, this is what Star Wars should be. And it is the worst fucking thing you've ever seen. It is just like everything that is wrong with it. It's everything that you were saying. That's like, it's the Annie Wilkes that don't care about it being fair. They just want to be fed their the things that make them remember, you know, the Ewok singing in 1983, right? It's like they don't want anything new. They don't, and if they do want it new, then it has to be only by their terms. Luke Skywalker can only be a badass that's never made a wrong decision and just crumples, you know, for, you know, AT-ATs with his mind, because that's what a badass Jedi does, right? Not, you know, it's like, it's weird reading this going, you know, Annie Wilkes actually kind of had an idea of what was right and wrong in terms of her fiction, but couldn't apply that to her real life, versus the loudest Annie Wilkeses that are out there now don't have any idea what they want. They just want to complain about something. I don't know. It's really shocking. And once again, another thing, you can't read this book or rewatch the movie and not just compare it to fandom if you're perpetually online anyway, like I am. But
it really would be a perfect time to, because if they remade the book again into another film, I think you would set it in modern day. Just the issue is that you'd have to work around the fact that nobody is that disconnected from the world. Like, she didn't have a phone in her house, which was a thing that could still occur in the 1980s, but
yep.
Now seems absurd. But yeah, it's so much different now, and the demands are so much harsher now, and so much of the algorithms kind of favor the people who are the worst at regulating their emotions. So it's just all tantrums all the time. And there's like still a subreddit about how bad the last season of Game of Thrones was. And that came out, it feels like a long time ago.
Yeah.
But they're still like sharing memes about how bad that final episode was. And it's like, what they want is to feel the same way they felt when this thing was fresh and new and they were younger. And they don't know how to ask for that. And because nobody can give it to them. That's you can keep making Ghostbusters movies. It's not going to make you feel the way you felt the first time you saw the original when it was a fresh new thing. There's, as you said, the system feeds those videos to people. Cause like, I never watched that stuff, but it will suggest it to me all the time, where it's a big thumbnail about how the wokes have ruined Disney. And it's just, this is what they want me to watch. And so those voices get the loudest. So in the updated version, Annie would have a significant online following and probably a hit vlog series complaining about the land. And she could get her frustrations out that way.
She'd definitely be a Snyder bro. So that is 100%.
How's he going to whack her in the head with what, a MacBook Air? It's just not, you need a little heft to that weapon.
Also, the idea that I, like, at this stage of my life, that I could go off to a cabin to write and would not have to do 13 social media posts a day of like, look, I found a deer in the yard. I'm 2,000 more words, because the way book marketing is done now, like, I have to be a public person every day. You have to like turn yourself into a celebrity, which is not a thing I wanted to do. But I just imagine the updated version of this, everybody immediately knows Paul has gone missing because he's not posted to Instagram for 5 hours. It's like, something's wrong.
He hasn't appeared on a random fan podcast.
He took a selfie holding up the final page of the manuscript with a cigarette. And that was the last post. That's 5 hours ago. Now, we know from the view at his window that this was in Colorado. We've pinpointed it here on the map. Like, the fans would show up within half a day.
Oh, it wouldn't be a Buster character if they remade this. It would be the internet sleuth. It totally would be. It would be the people that are, you know, geotagging his photos and, you know, and pinging cell towers and shit. You know, like, that's totally how it would be. It would be his fan holding him and his fans freeing him. That would be the angle, I think. Well, speaking of being on the promo circuit, I think we should probably bring this episode in for a landing. Jason, I want to give you the floor once again to promo your book. And also, Don, you have a book that people can check out now, don't you?
I want to stay out of Jason's way, because that's why we're here, is to promote. But yeah, I have a new book of fiction, and it's appropriately titled Fiction with a PH, because it's all about phantasm. They're a series of short stories or short novels all collected in a book. And it's my first my first public work of fiction. And it was, you know, some can accuse me of going for the low hanging fruit by setting it all in the Phantasm world. But Phantasm fans, I love it because I've got an origin story about our ice cream vendor hero, Reggie, and, you know, other characters from the original movie telling, you can see the story from different perspectives, Rashomon style almost.
Oh, that's rad.
Yeah.
You very graciously sent me a copy, and I am excited to dive into it.
Yeah, great. Yeah, it's for sale now on Amazon, so check it out. Phition, Tales from the World of Phantasm.
Great.
Okay, that's your cue now, Jason. Yeah. On your book.
You're up. Yeah. You're up, Jason.
Mine that is out right now in every possible format is I'm starting to worry about this black box of doom. It is available in audio, ebook, all of those. No, I do not read the audiobook. They have hired a professional to that. It would have been a disaster if they made me read it. If you want to check out me on TikTok, I'm Jason K. Pargin, P-A-R-G-I-N, on all of the platforms, on TikTok and Instagram and Twitter and Threads and Blue Sky and Facebook, all of them. It's always that same username.
Same for me, at Don Coscarelli everywhere.
Wonderful. Thank you, gentlemen. I really appreciate you guys joining me. This has been a really fun conversation.
Thanks, Eric. It's been a joy.
Thank you.
Many thanks to Jason Pargin and Don Coscarelli. Everybody go buy a copy of I'm Starting to Worry About This Black Box of Doom, and maybe rent a Phantasm or the Beastmaster or something. Do that to thank Jason and Don for coming on the show. Very impressed by their discussion. I really love digging into the actual written word of Misery. Like I said in the episode, pretty much the only time we talk about this on the KingCast proper is to talk about the movie. So it was nice to dive into the book, and I think they did a bang up job. And, I really like that Don Coscarelli. He's good people. And, Jason, just met him. And I think we're best friends now. So yes, thank those gentlemen for coming on. And let me tell you about what's coming up next week. So next week's going to be a crazy one. It will mark Flula Borg's triumphant return to the KingCast. And you know, we wouldn't just have him come back to talk about something deep and dark and serious. So that means it's time to return to the virtual world of The Lawnmower Man, the movie that was so bonkers that Stephen King sued to have his name removed from it. So we had a nice little deep dive into Misery, pure Stephen King, picking apart his words, and now we're looking at the thing that shares almost zero DNA with the original text. So much so that Stephen King sued them motherfuckers, I think, twice. So study up on your VR murder champs and refamiliarize yourself with Pierce Brosnan's single earring so you're ready for next week's shenanigans. It promises to be wild. Also, here's your friendly reminder to sign up for our Patreon over at patreon.com/thekingcast and get instant access to 4 years worth of bonus episodes, commentaries, and so much more. And I think that's all the housekeeping for this week. So we'll see you next week for Flula Borg taking on the Lawnmower Man. Adios, folks. The KingCast is a Fangoria podcast production. The show is produced, hosted, and created by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Scott Wampler. Tira Ansley and Abhi Goel are executive producers. Daniel Danger is our art director, and editing is done by yours truly.